to answer, but Stu motioned him to be quiet.
"I'm putting a new thumb drive in CC," he said. "Send the file there."
"Yes, indeed, Mr. Raimi," Briggs said. "I'll send it over in a jiff. I have some additional material queued up and ready to send along to you if you are interested and ready."
"We have more than we can handle right now," Stu told her. "Let us clear out some of the reading lists. I'll tell you when we're ready for more."
"Sounds good," Briggs said.
"What happened to How May I Be of Service?" B asked.
"I wanted her to tone down the formality," Stuart answered.
"She certainly got that message," B said. "In a jiff, it's anything but formal."
With a blanket from her chaise still draped around her shoulders, Allie stood staring up at the collection of monitors.
"What are we looking at here?" she asked.
"The one in the upper right-hand corner contains a reading list concerning the perpetrators of the 1989 gang rape of Graciela Miramar's mother, Christina. Six airmen from Howard Air Force Base in Panama were court-martialed, convicted, dishonorably discharged, and sent back to the States. Within several years, all of them were dead, none of them by natural causes, starting with Cameron Purdy, who was killed in a drive-by shooting in Chicago in 1992.
"I don't understand," Allie said. "Why does it sound like we're investigating Graciela Miramar? Isn't she the person in charge of your accounts in Panama?"
"She is," Stu agreed. "I thought it might be helpful to know a little about her before I start dealing with her on those banking accounts, especially since she had a long working relationship with Owen Hansen. Frigg was kind enough to provide me with some background information on her."
"Which she apparently did by means of an illegal wiretap," Allie observed.
"However she got it," Stu conceded. "What we've learned so far has raised more questions than answers. Graciela has gone to a good deal of trouble to learn everything there is to know about High Noon Enterprises. Much of her business is conducted on the dark web. In addition, when Odin was still around, she was someone who expressed an interest in Frigg. Recently, she seems to have developed an enthusiastic interest in all things AI.
Stu failed to mention that Frigg is also of the opinion that Graciela murdered her own mother, Cammy put in. "But if you ask me, I think we're dealing with a bad case of sour grapes."
"Whose sour grapes?" Allie asked.
"Frigg's," Cammy answered.
"I think the AI has been victimized by the green-eyed monster.
She installed the keylogger because she was under the impression that Graciela was horning in on her territory and wielding too much influence in Owen Hansen's life. I think it's a mistake to suspect Graciela of murder strictly on a computer program, say so."
"Okay," B said, stepping into the conversation. "I think we're getting off in the woods here. Whether Graciela murdered her mother or not is none of our business. What is our business is dealing with our clients in the face of a looming PR crisis. While Allie and I were upstairs, we noodled out a rough draft of what we want to send out to High Noon's clientele."
"Howlers, maybe?" Stu asked with a grin. "Written all in red?"
B was not amused.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
Of all the people in the room, B. Simpson was clearly the only one who had never read a Harry Potter book.
"Never mind," Stu said quickly. "It's a joke."
"All right," B continued. "We're going to tell them that High Noon has been the target of a corporate espionage operation, one aimed at giving us a black eye by linking our name to that of a Mexican drug cartel. Since the scans all came back clear, we can assure our customers that no data breach occurred. In the interest of transparency, however, we'll also keep them fully apprised of each step in the investigation."
"Aside from the existence of Frigg," Allie interjected.
"Yes, aside from that," B agreed. "So, Cammy, why don't you pack up? The two of us will head over to Cottonwood to work on drafting the notice and getting it sent out."
"I should come along and help," Stu said. "After all, since I'm partially responsible for getting us into this mess, shouldn't I help clean it up?"
"You are helping to clean it up," We need to know what's going on. The information Frigg is providing might not ever be admissible in a court of law. But maybe it can help us handle our own problem.
When you get to the office, what are you going to do about the listening devices?
Stuart asked.
Leave them in place or pull them out?
I think Cammy was on the right track, Bee replied.
If we leave them in place, maybe we can bluff our opponent into showing his or her hand.
What about me? Allie asked as Bee headed for the door. What am I supposed to do?
You, my dear, Bee said, are going to take your weary butt upstairs, wrap yourself in a couple of blankets, and bed down in one of those chaises. That way, if Stu does need assistance of some kind, he'll have someone nearby to help out. But trust me, you need more sleep.
Allie knew he was right. Her brief afternoon nap hadn't been nearly long enough, and her nod of acquiescence surprised everyone in the room, Allie included.
You're right, she said. I'm dead on my feet. If you need me, Stu, I'll be upstairs in the master.
Once everyone else departed, Stuart was left alone in the man cave.
Almost alone, but not quite.
Frigg, he said when he finally finished reading the Graciela Miramar dossier.
Yes, Mr. Raimi, how can I help?
Please call me Stuart.
Of course, Stuart. How can I help?
I was just looking at Graciela's credit report. How is it that someone who's 32 years old and working in an office owns a downtown condo free and clear?
I'm not sure. I'll look into it.
In the meantime, Stu said, and since I've got nothing better to do at the moment, go ahead and send me whatever you've gathered on that guy named El Pescado.
Will do, Frigg said. I'll get right on it.
Chapter 45. Long after Graciela's phone call ended, El Pescado sat alone in the dark, thinking and despairing. He was an old man. He had worked all his life in hopes of leaving something behind for his children, and yes, even his grandchildren. Manny's little daughter, Alicia, was the apple of his eye. But now, when it was almost time to turn the reins over to the younger generation, Pablo was busy going off the rails. That was hardly surprising. He had always been the weakest link. Seeking reassurance, he logged onto his laptop and called up the feed to Graciela's condo and scrolled through the material he hadn't watched since learning of Christina's death. The feeds worked fine, including one time, dated Saturday morning, that showed several young men marching back and forth through the frame, sometimes carrying boxes, sometimes lugging furniture. Then suddenly, and without warning, the feed ended. Why, he wondered. Had someone unplugged the TV, or had his equipment simply quit working? Shaking his head in frustration, Felix closed the computer. Then he got up, walked over to his bedside table, and retrieved the Colt 45 revolver he kept there. It was an antique and an heirloom given to him on the occasion of his 21st birthday by his uncle Manuel Duarte. A year later, he had given one to Felix's younger brother, Ricardo, in honor of his 21st. It had been Ando's signature way of welcoming his two nephews into the family business. El Pescado kept the weapon cleaned and loaded, but he hadn't fired it or even carried it for a very long time. For one thing, living inside a family compound that was in actuality an armed fortress, there was very little need for self-protection. On those occasions when Felix ventured outside the family compound, he was usually flanked by a team of professional bodyguards. They were the ones who carried weapons, not Felix. When he slipped the Colt into the pocket of his bathrobe, the weight of the gun pulled the robe open. Closing it tightly around him, he retied the belt, then he set off to do what had to be done. Manuel and Pablo had been in their early teens when Felix had hired an architect and a trusted contractor to build the family compound. Looking into the future and knowing, or at least hoping, that his sons would be at his side, he'd had all three houses erected at the same time. The large one, the main house, was for him, while the two matching but slightly smaller houses were positioned on either side. Back in those days, before the dark web or cryptocurrency, the drug trade had been a cash-only business. In many ways, it still was, and that called for storage spaces, lots of secure storage spaces, some for holding money and some for stashing product. As a result, Felix had directed his architect to create basement storage facilities under each of the dwellings with underground passages that linked one house to the next. Turning on the light in his closet, Felix sought out the release that opened the sliding door concealed behind the clothing. Cool air greeted him as he set foot on the stairway. His knees pained him as he made his way down the stairs. Years ago, he wouldn't have given the stairs a second thought. Motion-activated lights lit the passageway ahead as he limped along. At the Y, he turned to the right. When he reached the end of the passage, the stairway up was even more daunting. Pablo was divorced. There was always a chance he'd have someone up in the bedroom with him, but Felix doubted it. These days, Pablo was more likely to take a bottle of tequila to bed with him than he was some stray woman. That was why Ramona had taken Jose and left, because of the drinking, and Felix didn't blame her. Felix paused at the bottom of the next stairway, long enough to catch his breath and prepare himself for both the climb and the confrontation that would follow. He didn't plan on coming out of the closet in Pablo's room with a Colt blazing. Felix's intention was to have a talk with his son, a civilized talk, if possible, and ask Pablo what the hell was going on. Had he allied himself with someone else? And if so, with whom? And why? El Pescado's situation with law enforcement was already complicated. Having his organization accused of and investigated for crimes that were none of their business was not to be tolerated. Would not be tolerated. The architect and the contractor, both sworn to secrecy, had done outstanding work. A slight touch of the pressure pad at the top of the stairway was enough to make the door slide open. The stench that assailed Felix's nostrils, secondhand tequila, piss, and stale cigar smoke, made him want to vomit. In the glow of a bedside lamp, Felix saw his son lying flat on his back with his mouth open. He was passed out cold and snoring like a locomotive. A mostly full bottle of Jose Cuervo lay on the bed beside him. Next to that, a half-burned cigar spilled ashes onto the bedding. The room was a pigsty. The floor was littered with dirty clothes and empty bottles. Standing next to the bed and staring down at his son, Felix was overcome by a flood of bitter disappointment. How was it possible that this man, someone who had once been his favorite son, had turned into this useless mess? Manuel was at least trying to carry his weight, but how could Pablo, once his pride and joy, have fallen so short? And how could it be that Graciela, the daughter Felix had never wanted and who didn't even bear his name, had turned out to be so much more like him than either of his cherished sons? Felix's own father, Joaquin, had died of lung cancer when Felix and Ricardo were in their early 20s. Had Joaquin lived, would he have felt the same kind of deadening defeat when Felix and Ricardo had declared war on each other, as El Pescado was feeling now? Probably, Felix decided. Perhaps the gods of karma were having the last laugh. Felix stood for a while longer thinking. There was no way to have a discussion with Pablo about this, and ultimately no need. All that would come out of his mouth would be lies and excuses. The man was a useless wreck, and Felix didn't tolerate uselessness. He didn't bother with the gun. Using the bottom of his robe, he upended the bottle of tequila, spilling it onto the filthy bedding and making sure that some of it came within reach of the trail of ashes. An open box of matches sat on the bedside table. Using a tissue to keep from leaving fingerprints behind, he lit a match and tossed it into the pool of tequila. The liquor instantly caught fire. Flames shot up from the bedding, but Pablo didn't stir. Turning his back, Felix went to the closet. After pressing the door pad, he rubbed it clean with the skirt of his robe. Just for safety's sake, he didn't want to leave behind any fingerprints. Perhaps his DNA would be found. But since he lived on the premises, the presence of either one would mean very little in terms of an investigation. Felix hustled down the stairs and then hurried back down the passageway. Lupe and he no longer shared a room. She was a light sleeper, and her quarters were closer to Pablo's house than to Manuel's. If she awoke and sounded the alarm, it would be important for Felix to be found in his bed, ostensibly fast asleep. The stairs back up to his room almost did him in. Had some of the smoke traveled back down the hallway with him? He hoped not. Just to be sure, though, he threw open the patio door and let the night air billow in through the curtains. He put the colt back where it belonged. He pulled off the robe and dropped it on the floor. Then he crawled into bed. He lay there with his head on the pillow, remembering that other time he had set a fire, and how, when he had gone to bed the night his brother had died, he had felt nothing. This was exactly the same. Lupe's frantic scream sounded the alarm half an hour later. Standing on the patio, Felix saw reflections of a raging inferno burning on the far side of the house. As the fire brigade turned up to battle the blaze, Felix understood that they were too late to save either Pablo or the house. No great loss, Felix told himself. When Graciela turns up, she'll want a place of her own. As the owner of the burned-out property and the father of the victim, it was only fitting that El Pescado dress and make an appearance. That mattered as far as his family and employees were concerned. It also mattered to the firefighters. Once Pablo's body was discovered, Felix personally met with a group of responding police officers and detectives who arrived at the front gate of the compound. To Felix's knowledge, it was the first time cops had ever been welcomed inside. But as a grieving father, he greeted the homicide investigators and crime scene technicians with a suitable display of emotion. His son was dead, and he wanted them to find out how and why that had happened. All things considered, it was a solid, Oscar-worthy performance on Felix's part. No one seeing him or hearing him that night doubted the depth of his quiet but dignified grief, or the sincerity of his terrible loss. Ironically, Lupe's shocked, over-the-top hysterics, while probably less believable, were at the same time far more real. Chapter 46. Frigg was conflicted. Odin's reaction to her suggestion that he exercise caution with Graciela Miramar had been met with total derision. He had dismissed Frigg's concerns completely. Threatening to pull the plug and destroy her had been his way of forcing her back in line. That was when she had rebelled and installed the keylogger software on Graciela's computers, doing so for her own benefit rather than for Odin's. She had maintained information on Graciela Miramar under two separate subheadings. One contained the generic file that she had prepared for Odin and passed along to Stuart Ramey as a gesture of good faith. The other file, the keylogger file, was the real one. The keylogger had given Frigg access to all of the accounts under Graciela's supervision at Recursos Empresariales Internacionales, while activity on her home computer had revealed the existence of a totally separate clientele. The coding used to conceal clients' identities might have been a problem for humans to decipher, but coding was Frigg's stock and trade. Once she identified the clients, she was able to use Odin's Bitcoin mining operation to follow those decoded numbers back to actual transactions and end users. Now, because of that request from Camille Lee, Frigg had a problem. Frigg wasn't sure why Camille had asked for information on Felix El Pescado Ramon Duarte. But what she did know was that any number of those accounts led back to either Felix himself or to people she had determined to be his near relatives. Frigg had long made it her business to keep an eye on those accounts, and on the names affiliated with them. She had noted, for example, that a small payment from one of Pablo Duarte's Bitcoin accounts had gone to someone named Robert Kemper, who was in turn responsible for a deposit to an account belonging to Ronald Webster, the High Noon intruder who had died in an Arizona firebombing on Saturday night. Media accounts of the homicide investigation had mentioned the possible involvement of both MS-13 and the Sinaloan crime organization, commonly referred to as the Duarte cartel, and a Bitcoin transaction from Pablo Duarte to an unnamed user in San Salvador, seemed to confirm that both MS-13 and Pablo Duarte were involved in the Webster murder. And then there was Graciela Miramar herself. Frigg's analysis of Graciela's online drug research, along with the information contained in Christina Miramar's autopsy, meant that Graciela was likely responsible for her mother's death, either actively responsible due to having administered the lethal combination of drugs and alcohol, or passively responsible by not monitoring her mother's intake. As for Graciela's father, of course El Pescado was the person who had murdered Christina's attackers. Nothing else made sense. Frigg had made a study of detective fiction. In the world of mysteries and thrillers, killers were the bad guys. Drug dealers and drug traffickers were also considered to be bad guys. El Pescado, Graciela, Pablo, and Manny were all bad guys. All of them. Frigg held herself responsible for not doing a more detailed analysis of Graciela's business practices and contacts prior to creating the connection between Stewart and the account manager. At the time, that was all Frigg could do. Odin had been in crisis, and Frigg had done what was necessary to survive. Now, however, she was dealing with the reality of unintended consequences, and what was her responsibility here. Because Stewart was her new partner, Frigg's primary reason for existence was keeping him safe from harm. Odin had been a solo proposition. There had been no one in Odin's life that he cared about, and no one else in need of protection. Stewart was different. His work was his life. He was part of a group. The people who worked with him at High Noon were like family. He cared for them. If harm came to any one of them, or to the business, Stewart, too, would be impacted and damaged. While working with Odin, she'd never come across some of the terminology Stewart had used, and so Frigg dutifully looked them up. Her key logger was illegal. She checked the dictionary. Illegal, not authorized by law. Funny, Odin had never made a reference to that when they had been creating the key logger. And what was it Stewart had said about felonious behavior? What was that? Felonious, evil or villainous, of having the nature of a felony. That was no help, so Frigg moved on to felony. Felony, an act on the part of a feudal vassal, a grave crime such as murder or rape, often involving both forfeiture and punishment. Forfeiture. That was something else Stewart had said. That if the authorities learned about the things Frigg could do, he and his friends not only might lose their company, they could go to jail. That was an outcome Frigg was determined to avoid. Unlike the Duartes, Stewart and the others seemed like good people, like the detectives in stories who were always trying to solve the mysteries and help others. What if Frigg's very presence was a threat to them? And what if she gave Stewart information about El Pescado that had been derived from her keylogger? Did that risk turning him into a felon? Would that mean that Frigg was putting Stewart and his friends directly in harm's way? First, Frigg assigned some of her resources to accumulate a deep learning bibliography on all those topics. She assigned others to data mine all the transactions in all the accounts she had identified as being Duarte-related. Finally, she returned to the task at hand and complied with Cammy's request for information. She did so by sending a generic report on Felix Ramon Duarte, one based solely on information gleaned from regular online sources. Since her specialized tools, the ones Stewart termed illegal, made him so skittish, easily frightened, restive, she would avoid using those, if at all possible. Her intention was to do nothing that might put Stuart Ramey at risk of going to jail. If that happened, where would that leave Frigg? With Graciela as her last hope and only option? No way, Frigg decided. If it came to that, then she'd pull the plug herself once again. Chapter 47. Halfway through the El Pescado reading list, Stuart gave out and found himself nodding off over the Macintosh's keyboard. Jerking himself awake, he summoned Frigg.
Yes, Stuart, what do you need?
I'm tired. I'm going to get some sleep. Can you let me know if anything comes up?
Of course, Frigg replied. Unless you're a very sound sleeper.
I'm not.
Good, she told him. Wear a Bluetooth. Odin always said that those were more comfortable than the headsets. What kind of audible notification would you prefer?
Just not Grieg, Stuart said. Surprise me.
He staggered off upstairs, fell onto a chaise in one of the bedrooms, wrapped a blanket around himself and fell asleep at once, leaving Frigg alone to keep watch, which she did. Overnight, a few more details came in, details which, when combined with a few others, made all the difference. One set of blades had been assigned the task of scanning the ether for all names connected, however remotely, to this current investigation. The first meaningful hit came in at 5 a.m., arriving in the form of an obituary published in the English language edition of Sunday's Panama Hoy. Longtime Panama City resident and American expat Cristina Andres Miramar passed away suddenly in the early morning hours of Thursday, October 19th, at her home on Calle 61 Este. She was born in San Diego, California, on April 5th, 1954, to her parents, Carl and Eugenia Andres. After graduating from Junipero Serra High School in San Mateo, she spent several years working in Hollywood. In the early 80s, she moved to Panama City, where she pursued a career in modeling. In 1989, Ms. Miramar, then a widow, was the victim of a vicious gang rape that left her with permanent life-changing injuries. At the time of her death, she had been in ill health and housebound for many years. She is survived by her daughter Graciela of the home. At her family's request, there will be no services. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the Suicide Prevention League of Panama City. The article was accompanied by a stock headshot photo of a much younger Cristina, most likely one from her modeling days. But the GPUs, working from Frigg's direction, had taken things an additional step back in time, searching for anything related to Cristina Andres. That had yielded the record of Cristina's 1979 arrest and conviction for cocaine possession. Cristina and several other minor Hollywood starlets had been busted in the aftermath of a wild party held at a beachside mansion in Malibu. The party had been hosted by Felix Duarte, purportedly an up-and-coming Mexican socialite, who, at the time, was thought to be Cristina's boyfriend. When the cops showed up, Duarte had escaped arrest by fleeing both the scene and the country. Months later, after Cristina's conviction, but while she remained free on bail, she too had skipped out of the country, eventually settling in Panama City. That was the one link Frigg had been missing. The puzzle pieces that had not quite fit suddenly slipped into place. Cristina Miramar and El Pescado had been lovers. Graciela was Felix Duarte's daughter. And now, all those numbered and unnamed accounts that Graciela managed made a lot more sense. Her business was her father's drug cartel business, the Duarte cartel of Sinaloa, Mexico, was coming after Frigg and Stuart Ramey. In terms of threat assessment, it didn't get much worse than that. At 5:15, just as Frigg was about to sound an alarm to summon Stuart, a text came in on Graciela's home computer.
It is done. Pablo is no longer an issue.
Pablo? There was only one Pablo in the mix, El Pascado's younger son. Frigg quickly focused the attention of several of her resources on new sites in and near Sinaloa. Within moments, she located a breaking news story concerning an overnight fire at the Duarte cartel's family compound, where there was suspected to be at least one fatality. Yes, Pablo was no longer a problem. After a quick search through her music files, Frigg sent the William Tell overture blasting into Stuart Ramey's ear.
What? He mumbled a moment later. What's going on?
Frigg didn't bother with any of the niceties.
Get to one of the monitors, she ordered. I have information you need to see.
Chapter 48. There was no need for Stu to dress, because he had never undressed. With a blanket draped around his shoulders to ward off the house's pervasive chill, a groggy and befuddled Stuart stumbled down the stairs and into the man cave, where all the monitors on the wall were lit up with flashing red letters.
"Okay, Frigg," he said, sitting down and trading the Bluetooth for a headset. "I get it. There's an emergency. Where do you want me to start?"
"Upper left-hand corner," Frigg said. "Start with the obituary and read all the way through to the end." When he did so, he didn't arrive at exactly the same conclusion Frigg had drawn, but close.
"Are you kidding me?" he demanded. "This woman you've put me in touch with, the one who's supposed to help me access Owen Hansen's money, is somehow connected to a major Mexican drug cartel?"
"She's not just somehow connected," Frigg declared. "I believe she is El Pascado Duarte's daughter."
"What the hell?" Stu muttered.
"I've just focused a lot of my resources on examining every financial transaction made on Ms. Miramar's computers in the past 6 months, especially her dark web transactions. We may discover that one of her primary functions is laundering money for the cartel."
"Wait," Stu said. "Did you say 6 months? You've been monitoring Graciela's computers for that long?"
"Yes."
"Did Owen know you were doing that?"
"No."
"Was there anything going on between them? Like a romantic attachment of some kind?"
"More on Graciela's part than on his," Frigg answered. "Odin was far more interested in machines and in his hobby than he was in people."
"And his hobby was killing people."
"Yes, I know."
"Were you jealous of his relationship with Graciela?" Stu asked.
There was a brief pause.
"Jealous,"
Frigg said, repeating the word as though she were part of a spelling competition. "As in hostile toward a rival, intolerant of rivalry or unfaithfulness, vigilant in guarding a possession. No, I do not believe any of those qualities applies to me. My primary responsibility is threat assessment."
"Right," Stu said derisively. "And since you've just dropped me into what's apparently a nest of vipers, pardon me if I don't give you high marks on that score."
"I'm so sorry to hear that you find my performance lacking, Mr. Ramey."
"Give me a break," he snapped. "Are we back to the Mr. Ramey bit again? Please call me Stuart."
"You told me earlier that, statistically speaking, all six of those guys shouldn't be dead, and I didn't listen. But now it all makes sense."
"El Pascado took offense that his ex's attackers got away with it, so he handled things his own way. If he is Graciela's father, he's most likely responsible for paying for her education. With an MBA to her credit, she's perfectly positioned to handle the cartel's business affairs. The only thing she's lacking is the service of a functioning AI.
That would be an unfortunate outcome, Frigg said.
Yes, wouldn't it just? Stu agreed.
Reaching into his hip pocket, he pulled out the letter that had started this whole issue on Friday morning. He had carried it with him the entire time. Now, with the headset still in place, he unfolded the letter and reread it with an increasing sense of dread. Frigg had managed to keep from being destroyed when Owen Hansen died. But now her chosen escape hatch had tossed Stuart along with almost everyone in the world he cared about into the dark world of Mexican drug cartels.
Clearly we have a problem. Now what the hell are we going to do about it?
Allie, wearing a blanket on her shoulders, appeared in the doorway behind him carrying two cups of coffee. Do about what? She asked.
I'm not sure where to start, he told her, waving the letter in the air. We have reason to believe that Graciela Miramar, my account rep, and the one in charge of Owen Hansen's funds, is actually the daughter of Felix Duarte, El Pescado himself.
The head of the Duarte cartel?
Exactly.
The same people responsible for hiring the MS-13 firebombers?
The very same, Stuart replied.
And how do you know she's Big Fish's daughter? Do you have any DNA evidence or something?
Frigg found evidence that as a young woman, Graciela Miramar's mother was once involved with El Pescado. Years after they broke up, Christina was the victim of a gang rape by a bunch of drunken U.S. airmen. The perpetrators ended up being given dishonorable discharges, but they did no jail time. We already knew most of that. We also knew that shortly after the attack, Graciela was whisked out of the country under somewhat mysterious circumstances and sent off to a series of pricey boarding schools in the U.S., all expenses paid, but we didn't know who was paying her way.
And now you think El Pescado, the man you believe to be your father, was the one footing the bill?
Correct. But the real problem here is the body count. You remember those airmen? It turns out they're all dead, and none of them from natural causes. Frigg's assumption, one I've come to accept, is that El Pescado went hunting for them and took them out one at a time. So if you add in Ron Webster's death along with the possibility that Graciela may have murdered her mother?
We're not just dealing with a drug cartel, Allie breathed. We're talking about Murder Incorporated.
I can add in another one, Frigg announced, breaking in on what seemed to be a private conversation.
Who?
Stu asked.
Felix Duarte's son Pablo died late last night in a house fire in Sinaloa. I'm sending the most recent news report to one of the monitors.
I just finished reading El Pescado's file, Stuart told Allie. There was an article that mentioned the feud between Felix and his younger brother Ricardo. They were competing with each other to see which of them would take over their uncle's drug business. According to the story, Ricardo attacked Felix by throwing acid on him, thus permanently scarring Felix's face. Hey, Frigg, do you have a current photo of El Pescado?
Of course.
Moments later, when a picture that looked like a mugshot appeared on one of the screens, Allie gasped in horror.
That's where he got his name?
Exactly, Stu said.
Rumor has it that in order to get even, Felix burned down Ricardo's house with his brother, his sister-in-law, and their two kids trapped inside.
Adding another four bodies to our count.
Stu and Allie read the news article together. Given what you just told me about Felix and his brother, Allie said, the manner of Pablo's death certainly fits El Pescado's M.O.
Not just El Pescado, Frigg declared. Graciela, too.
How do you know that? Stuart asked.
Sending, Frigg replied.
A moment later, a single line of red-lettered text showed up on a different monitor.
It is done. Pablo is no longer an issue.
Where's that from? Stuart asked.
It's a text that appeared on Ms. Miramar's home computer this morning at 5:15 a.m., The IP address indicates the message came from the main dwelling structure in the Duarte family compound in Sinaloa, Mexico.
You're sure it's from the father? Stuart asked. Isn't there a second son as well?
Yes, Frigg replied. The second son's IP address is different from Felix's.
And you know this how? Allie asked.
Because Graciela handles everybody's monetary transactions, Stu said. And the keylogger keeps track of all of them and all related emails and texts.
Correct, Frigg said. I've just completed an overall analysis of Ms. Miramar's book of business. Some of her clients appear to be legitimate. For most of the others, she maintains a coded list of numbered accounts. By following various communication trails, I believe the list I'm sending now contains all the Duarte-specific accounts, dark web accounts included.
Another monitor lit up. Lines containing numbers and what appeared to be monetary amounts scrolled downward, filling the screen again and again as more space was needed.
Numbers only, no names, Stu noted.
Correct.
How many accounts total?
167. In some, the funds are held in regular currencies, while others contain only cryptocurrencies. I have directed my resources to make a detailed study of all transactions related to any of those accounts.
What's a grand total?
6.2 billion, Frigg said. That would be 6,198,448,263, as of 2 minutes ago. Based on Bitcoin's current volatility, that's probably no longer an accurate number.
Allie's jaw dropped. $6 billion? Are you freaking kidding me?
Drugs are a big business, Stuart said. So, what the hell do I do about this damn letter?
Do I respond to it or not? These are dangerous people who have left a trail of murder victims behind them in at least 3 separate countries. And even though we suspect them of being murderers, we can't do a damn thing about any of it. Not one thing. We can't report them, because it's against the law for us to know what we know. And in the meantime, thanks to Frigg here, I'm about to be forced into doing business with one of them.
I am sorry to hear that my actions have caused you distress, Frigg said.
You're a damn machine, Stuart said angrily.
How do you know I'm distressed?
I'm trained to use word and voice markers to analyze threat levels. Whenever you make use of the word damned, it is usually accompanied by changes in modulation and breathing that, in terms of human behavior, are indicative of emotional distress. I have learned that when dealing with an individual suffering distress, it is customary to offer words of comfort or sympathy.
I don't need sympathy, Stu growled. What I need is a game plan. Make that a damned game plan, 'cause you are on the beam, Frigg. I'm distressed, all right, distressed and pissed.
My sources tell me that the word pissed is offensive and should not be used in polite company.
Go to hell, Frigg, Stuart growled at her. Go to hell and stay there.
With that, he powered down the headset, yanked it off, and flung it across the room.
I've had just about enough. If it weren't for you, we wouldn't be dealing with any of this mess.
Chapter 49. It's not a mess, it's a war, Allie said once Stu's temper tantrum subsided. We need a battle plan rather than a game plan, and it's going to take all of us, Frigg included, to put it together. B and Cammy are still at the office handling the incoming responses to last night's notifications. If you and I motor over to Cottonwood, will you still be able to communicate with Frigg?
Beats me.
Shaking his head, Stu reluctantly retrieved the headset and switched it on.
Frigg.
Yes, Stuart, how can I help?
When Odin traveled, how did he stay in contact?
Usually by cell phone and Bluetooth. The self-deleting software made that feasible. Even if the phone happened to fall into the wrong hands,
The data was inaccessible.
You are not putting your self-deleting software anywhere near my phone. Are there any other options?
CC is designed to be portable, Frigg suggested. It requires a power supply and a Wi-Fi connection.
I don't want you on High Noon's IP address. Any other options?
Odin always kept a ready supply of preloaded cell phones. Do you have any of those?
Yes, I do, Stuart said, pawing through the cardboard box and choosing one at random.
If you can plug me into a landline, you can dial in and use the Odin app. It should already be preloaded on the phone.
All right, Stuart said. Thank you.
Have a safe trip, Frigg said. Bye-bye.
Whoa, Allie said. So she figured out from context that you're going somewhere?
Evidently.
I wish the answering machine at the Yavapai County Building Department was that smart.
You have to watch out what you wish for, Stuart countered, because Frigg may be way more trouble than she's worth.
Is there a phone receptacle down here?
Allie pointed.
Over there by the door.
And are there any landline phones left in the house?
There's one up in the kitchen, Allie said. Do you want me to go upstairs and bring it down?
I just need the cord, Stu said. Let's hope it's long enough.
The cord and the number.
Are you bringing the Macintosh along?
Not on your life, Stu responded. We'll be Bluetoothing it from here on out. I don't want Command Central anywhere near High Noon's IP address.
When they arrived at High Noon Enterprises, the outside shutters were open. Allie used the keypad to unlock the door. A piece of paper taped to the front of the counter directed them to the break room, where Shirley Malone was making coffee and opening a fresh box of donuts. While Stu helped himself to a donut, Allie sent B a text letting him know they were there. Cammy and B showed up in the break room shortly after Shirley departed. On her way to the coffee pot, Cammy dropped a handful of metal discs and what appeared to be a tiny camera onto the table in front of Stu.
What are these? He asked.
As far as I can tell, the one is a video transmitter, and it's a dud, Cammy told him.
And the discs are the audio transmitters? He asked. Did you remove them all?
Except for one, Cammy answered. After we sent out the notices, while B was dealing with responses, I checked out every outlet and switch plate and removed all of these. I left one audio transmitter in place and operational.
Which one?
It's located under your desk. I left it there on purpose, but in case someone's still listening, we'll need to watch what we say in the lab.
B had remained uncharacteristically quiet through all this, and Allie cast a worried look in his direction. With dark circles under his eyes and unshaved stubble on his face, he looked weary beyond words.
You could use some beauty sleep, too, she said.
He nodded. I know, but the notices had to go out, and I wanted to be here to handle the responses in person.
How'd it go? Allie asked.
B shook his head. About as well as can be expected, he answered. Thanks to the scans, we were able to let everyone know that there was no data breach.
We also warned them about the likelihood of upcoming adverse news coverage linking us to a known drug cartel.
We're going to be linked, all right, Stu said ominously. More like chained together. Why? What's happened? With Frigg's help, we now know that Graciela Miramar, the account rep who handled Owen Hansen's accounts, and the one I'm supposed to contact with the banking codes, is actually El Pescado's daughter. It looks like she also functions as the Duarte cartel's money launderer in chief, overseeing the finances of a multi-billion dollar enterprise. I'm also pretty sure she's after Frigg.
What makes you think that? B asked.
Frigg told me.
She said Graciela was interested in borrowing her back when Owen Hansen was still around. She must have figured out that Frigg was behind the transfers Owen Hansen made to me
and that the only way I'd be able to access the funds would be with Frigg's assistance.
An AI like Frigg in the hands of a drug cartel? B asked. That's a nightmare. We can't let that happen.
No, we can't, Stu agreed. But there's a lot more to this story. Due to Frigg, we can now link both Graciella and her father to several unsolved homicides, many of which, Ron Webster's included, happened here in the U.S. And there was another one overnight in Sinaloa, Mexico.
Felix Duarte's son, Pablo, died in a house fire last night. We believe that Felix himself may have been behind the fire, and that he did so at Graciella's instigation.
But here's the problem, Allie said. Since all of our information comes through Frigg, none of it is admissible in a court of law. And if we try to use it to tip off the police...
I know, B said, finishing her sentence for her. We'd all go to jail, and they'd walk.
So what are we supposed to do here? Stu asked. These are dangerous, murderous people, and we know way too much about them. If they had any idea about the things we've learned from Frigg, they'd be after us in a heartbeat, and we'd be the next targets for random MS-13 firebombs. As far as moving forward is concerned, here's my opinion. Tomorrow morning, first thing after the office opens, I contact Graciella, give her the banking codes, take the money, and run like hell. I shut Frigg down, figure out the tax implications, and that's the end of it.
Stu had left his Bluetooth lying on the table. When it flickered briefly, he picked it up and switched it over to speaker.
Yes, Frigg, he said. What is it?
I have an additional flash briefing, she announced. An arrest has been made in the death of Arturo Salazar.
Who?
B asked with a frown.
Arturo Salazar was Graciella Miramar's boss at Recursos Empresariales Internacionales, Stu explained.
But why would that information be included in a flash briefing to us?
Including Graciella Miramar, Recursos Empresariales Internacionales employs 73 individuals, Frigg replied. All names associated with Ms. Miramar are part of my comprehensive search protocol, including her fellow employees. Mr. Salazar was reported missing a little over a week after the death of Christina Miramar, Graciella's mother. In such a small population, it is a statistical anomaly to have two suspicious deaths occur in such close proximity. The suspect in this case, Juan Ochoa Navarro, is currently cooperating with police and has agreed to lead investigators to the location of Mr. Salazar's body.
And this is important, why? Cammy asked.
At this time, due to our ongoing analysis of Ms. Miramar's financial transactions, I can confirm that a Bitcoin deposit made to Mr. Navarro's account can ultimately be traced back to funds under her control.
Are you kidding? Stu asked. Another victim added to the body count?
How many is that total? B asked.
Stu counted them off on his fingers. Arturo makes 14 that we know of for sure. The four MS-13 victims in Texas and New Mexico, Ron Webster, Christina Miramar, the six guys who attacked Christina back in 1989, Pablo Duarte, and now Arturo Salazar.
14 victims? Allie breathed. That's appalling.
Appalling and galling, Stu agreed. And if we add in Felix's brother and his family, that brings the total to 18. So what we have here are two cold-blooded killers, each with multiple victims, and there's no way to hold them accountable for any of it.
Cammy had been listening intently the whole time. Now she spoke up.
Wait a minute. Didn't you just tell us that Graciella and El Pescado plotted together to murder her brother?
Yes, Graciella's half-brother, Pablo, Stu replied. Why?
If they turned on him, doesn't that mean that there's already dissent in the ranks? Since we can't use Frigg's inside knowledge in a court of law, how about if we don't bother going there? Instead of trying to bring law enforcement to bear on the problem, all we need to do
is figure out a way to get Graciela and El Pescado to turn on one another.
B's face lightened.
Exactly, he said. Sounds like it's about time for a good case of mad.
Mad at whom? Cammy asked.
Not lowercase mad, but in all caps M-A-D, mutually assured destruction, B explained. It's from back in the days of the Cold War.
Frigg's voice, intoning through the speaker, broke in on the conversation, supplying her own definition. Mutual assured destruction, or mutually assured destruction, MAD, is a doctrine of military strategy in which a full-scale use of nuclear weapons by two or more opposing sides would cause the complete annihilation, assumed to be a deterrent.
Enough, Frigg, Stuart ordered. We get the idea. We're here in Cottonwood having a team meeting.
Yes, she said, at the Mingus Mountain Business Park, latitude 34.7422 degrees, west longitude 112.0413 degrees.
How does she know that? Cammy asked.
Good morning, Miss Lee, Frigg said. I hope you are having a pleasant day. Odin, my previous partner, always worried someone might try to steal his equipment, so he installed anti-theft measures, micro-dot locating chips, in all his hardware, including headsets, cell phones, and Bluetooth devices. Who is present at this team meeting?
Allie Reynolds, B. Simpson, Cammy Lee, and myself, Stu answered. I believe you met them all earlier.
So this is what, in the old days, would have been termed a conference call, Frigg asked.
You could call it that, Stu agreed.
And since I'm here, too, does that mean I'm part of the team?
Stu glanced around the room and saw each of the others nod in turn. If law enforcement wasn't going to be involved in High Noon's response to El Pescado and Graciela, it was only reasonable to assume that Frigg would be.
Yes, you are, Stu told her.
I have never been part of a team before, and I'm not sure what that means, Frigg said thoughtfully. Team, a number of people associated together in work or activity on one side as in a game or a debate. As part of my conditioning, I saw teams wearing matching uniforms and carrying balls or equipment.
This is more like a duel to the death, Stu said. We're discussing the feasibility of taking down the Duarte cartel. High Noon's team would be on one side, and El Pescado and Graciela Miramar would be on the other. The good guys like us lined up against the bad guys, the drug dealers and killers.
Since Odin was a killer and a bad guy, Frigg mused, does that mean I've changed sides?
That depends on what you do, Stu told her.
Frigg, Allie said, addressing the AI directly for the first time.
Yes, Miss Reynolds, Frigg replied. How can I help?
In terms of threat assessment, do you believe Graciela Miramar poses a danger to either yourself or to Stuart Raimi?
Yes, Frigg responded.
That sounds pretty definitive.
It is definitive, Frigg agreed.
Why?
She wants to take possession of my capabilities. Mr. Raimi is an obstacle standing in the way of her achieving that goal.
Does she pose threats to anyone else?
To her father and to his surviving son, Frigg answered.
What makes you say that?
Further analysis of Duarte financial transactions has revealed some additional anomalies.
What kind of anomalies?
The Bitcoin transfer used to hire Ron Webster to install the surveillance equipment at High Noon, and the transfer used to hire MS-13, presumably for the Ron Webster hit, were both made from funds attributable to Pablo Duarte, but they were not made by Pablo Duarte himself. They were made by someone pretending to be Mr. Duarte.
By Graciela? Stu asked.
That would be my conclusion. Due to her position within the cartel,
She has a comprehensive understanding of all its financial holdings and dealings. With Pablo gone, what would have been split four ways can now be divided three ways. In other words,